You know, we all ask ourselves the same questions. Why are we here? What comes next? Is that all there is? The current scientific paradigm tells us that when we die, that's it. That's the end. That many of the experiences that people report over the centuries, things that happen to them for real, are not real. They can't exist, and therefore they don't. You know, the disconnect between centuries of human experience and rigid doctrine is maybe one reason why so many people have given up on science in ways that are probably inappropriate and unfair and also possibly dangerous. Is there a way to reconcile the seemingly bizarre experiences that people have reported through the centuries, out-of-body experiences, missing time, time slips, near-death encounters, other realities, science versus spirituality, science and religion? Is there a way to bridge all of that? Well, Dr. Christopher White has written a remarkable new book that offers a unique and new understanding of topics that we often discuss here on this program, but can't really explain. Other dimensions, other realities, whether or not this reality might bleed into others and vice versa. In a moment, we'll take a deep dive into the deep end of that pool, and I think you will be enthralled as I was when I read this. We'll be right back. Welcome back. Christopher White received his PhD in religious studies from Harvard University, where he studied religion and culture. He's interested in religion and science, spirituality and unchurched religion, new religious movements, electronic media and popular culture, and is currently a professor of religion at Vassar College. His new book, Other Worlds, Spirituality and the Search for Invisible Dimensions, is spectacular and mind-bending. Christopher, welcome to the program.
Good morning, George. Thanks for having me on the show.
Thanks for staying up so late. I was wondering, the first thing I was wondered when I finished this book was, how do you get away with this? You are a seemingly respectable guy teaching at a great school, and I wonder if you're going to catch grief for doing it.
Excuse me. How do I get away with it? It's, you know, a lot of people in cultural studies or people who are interested in the study of religion or, you know, we do get a pass to study really cool, fantastic things, right? People's unusual experiences and unusual states of consciousness, religious experiences, peak experiences, whatever you want to call them. So, yeah, it is kind of a privilege to be a professor and get a chance to just kind of follow my interests, and that's really how this book came along. It came out of an earlier book I was working on that looked at sort of the science of religious experience and spirituality. But as you know, this one moves in new directions by thinking about science and physics and cosmology and how these sort of fantastic scientific ideas have led to at least a new vocabulary that people are using now to talk about near-death experiences and peak experiences and even afterlife experiences and so on.
You mentioned in the beginning, and of course, as somebody who studies religious studies and religion and how it interacts with the world and popular culture, you mentioned in the beginning how belief in church, formal religion, organized religion is sort of plummeting around the Western world, but interest in spiritual and spirituality topics has remained strong or even increased. That's kind of a challenge for somebody in your line of work to figure out why that's happening.
Yeah, I think it is. And, you know, that's why a lot of us are trying to study these new forms of spirituality. I mean, that was really, as you say, that was really how I began the book with this puzzle, you know, or this problem, which is, you know, people still in America seem to have a lot of, I guess, what we would call spiritual beliefs. They, in pretty high numbers in America, believe in ghosts or believe in spirits or believe in God. And yet, on the other hand, as you say, participation in traditional religious congregations or affiliation in traditional religious congregations, those things seem to be going down. How can we think about this? How can we talk about this? You know, how is it the case that people seem to have a very robust sense of belief in other worlds and in spirituality in the absence, really in the absence of participation in traditional congregations? So that's what I tried to think about and try to think, well, where are people getting these ideas? You know, where are people getting their beliefs, their ideas about other worlds? And I'm kind of a big science documentary person, and I'm kind of like a science nerd in a sense, and interested in pop science books. And I think there's a lot of sort of fantastic scientific concepts that circulate now in our culture, and I think concepts like dark matter or dark energy, or even thinking about infinity, or thinking about the multiverse, or thinking about higher dimensions. I think all of these fantastic scientific concepts, which I think scientists themselves embrace with a sense of awe and mystery and wonder, I think those concepts are sort of the seedbed for new spiritual conceptions, and that's what I try to look at in the book.
Well, you know, I don't imagine you listen to the program all that often, but on this program we talk about some pretty wild stuff and things that scientists would have
a
hard time.
It's too late getting for me, George. It's too late.
Yeah, pretty wild stuff that I think mainstream scientists generally have a tough time getting their head around. Near-death experiences, out-of-body experiences, encounters with other realities, time slips, things of that sort, that you've sort of reached out, looked for a way to maybe make a bridge between science and those kinds of subjects with this understanding of parallel realities, other dimensions, higher dimensions. We talk about those kind of concepts on the program all the time as if it's a given. They're a given, but we don't really, I don't think many of us know. I can't get my head around other dimensions, and it hurts to even think about it. But you take a deep dive into sort of why those kind of concepts are so commonly held. So that was important not only to reach out to people like us who discuss these crazy things, but also to science, right?
Yeah, I think so. I mean, one thing I try to do in the book is I try to demystify a little bit the discussion about other dimensions. In the first couple chapters of the book, I ask the question, well, what is an extra dimension? And I talk a bit about that, and maybe I can just say a word about that for the listeners tonight.
Yes. Yeah. Go for it.
Yeah. The idea of another dimension is not that esoteric after all. I mean, we know we have three directions or dimensions, three spatial dimensions that we live in, and that's length, width, and height. And those are our three directions or dimensions. There's an additional dimension that we sometimes talk about as the fourth dimension since Einstein, and that's time. So we live in a four-dimensional space-time world, and Einstein spoke about this. But some of the people I talk about in my book talk about an additional spatial dimension, a direction in space or a dimension in space that's different from the other three. So, you know, we could think of like, we could draw a line on a piece of paper. A line is a one-dimensional object. It has length. If you then draw a flat square on that same piece of paper, it has two directions or dimensions. It has length and width. And then you could draw a cube on the paper, or you could hold a Rubik's Cube in your hand, and that would be a three-dimensional object. It has three spatial dimensions, length, width, and height. And then the question becomes is, okay, what about a fourth direction or a fourth dimension? And this would be, this would be an object that has length, width, height, and something else. Okay, and the something else is the tricky part. The something else is the direction that we cannot perceive. So if there is such a direction to reality or dimension to reality, it's evidently not something that we can see or perceive. So this is the possibility raised by mathematicians and actually others, some philosophers going back to the 18th century, but really in the 19th century, mathematicians raised this possibility, right? It seems like kind of a strange thing to think about. Well, how could there be another direction or dimension to reality? And why would there be one? Well, mathematicians in the 19th century start to use this idea within the context of their mathematical equations. And the reason they do is they want to make the mathematics of the universe, of its forces and laws, more simple and more elegant. And they find that it works. They find that by incorporating an extra spatial dimension, a fourth spatial dimension, that the mathematics of the universe's laws and forces look better. The equations look cleaner. They seem simpler, more elegant, and so on. So, and in fact, just to skip forward to today you still have mathematicians doing the same thing. You still have mathematicians incorporating within the context of their within the context of their mathematical equations, higher spatial dimensions, not just fourth spatial dimensions, but even fifth, sixth, seventh, even more. And these are string theorists. I don't know if you or your members of your audience have heard of string theory, but...
Sure, yeah.
So yes, there's string theory, M theory, brain theory. So these are basically mathematical theories that incorporate these other dimensions, and they do it, again, in order to make simpler and more elegant the basic equations that govern the universe. They're string theorists and theoretical physicists and mathematicians who do this are really trying to wrestle with one problem, and it really is the biggest problem in modern physics. And the problem is that we have two sets of equations that seem to govern reality. And we know that both sets of equations are correct, but we also know that they don't fit together. So we have a set of equations that govern very small things in the universe, and that govern the subatomic world, or the atomic world, the world of the quantum. And we know those equations work. We know they're correct. On the other hand, we have a set of equations that govern the movement of the very large, so planets and suns and galaxies and so on. And these are Einstein's theories of general relativity. We know both of those sets of equations are correct, but we also can't see a way for them to fit together. They don't fit together. So string theorists and others are assuming that there are additional spatial dimensions, and they're using them in order to come up with a single set of mathematical equations that would be encompassing, and that would put together the other equations that we have.
It's in between sort of the Einsteinian version and the quantum version. Yeah. You have things like spooky action at a distance, which scientists have struggled to explain. Entanglement theory, right?
Oh, absolutely, absolutely. Yeah, I mean, you know, mathematicians who work on these subjects also have to wrestle with other mysteries, right? There are other mysteries revealed by quantum mechanics, for sure. You know, they're definitely trying to wrestle with the problem of having two sets of equations that don't fit together, and they're using higher dimensional concepts to try to work on that. But as you say, yes, there's other strange and uncanny implications of quantum physics that have found their way into pop culture, for sure. You know, and all these ideas, I think, to some extent, have found their way into pop culture, and I try to talk about that in the book as well, right? The book is not just about scientists working on these ideas. The book is about scientists who work on these ideas, but then scientists who then have religious experiences and then try to use these ideas to think about them, and then even other people who have religious experiences and start to talk about them as higher dimensional or somehow related to some concepts in physics.
Maybe we could use Flatland as an illustration. It's both an illustration and sort of an inspiration for a lot of the people who you write about in this book. Tell us about Flatland, and I guess it was a pop culture phenomenon when it came out.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, Flatland's a great little book. So Flatland's kind of a classic science fiction or math fiction book written a long time ago, written in 1884. But it has quite a cultural life, and in fact, I remember reading Flatland in high school calculus. So, you know, math students all over the world still read Flatland as a way of kind of expanding our thinking about, you know, what does it mean to live in the kinds of spaces and kind of dimensions we live in. So, yeah, it's a great little book written by an Anglican priest named Edwin Abbott. He was British. He was raised in the middle of the 19th century, coming to age in an era of science and wrestling with what it meant to be religious and scientific at the same time. You know, it was a time, you know, this 1859 was Darwin's Origin of Species, and there were a number of challenges, I guess you'd say, to Christianity in Edwin Abbott's time. So he ended up writing this wonderful book, Flatland, which is a book about a lower dimensional, two-dimensional world, and he wrote it in order to get people think more about the possibility that other kinds of worlds could exist embedded in our own. Maybe we live in a higher dimensional universe. But Abbott's flat world was a two-dimensional world. The book takes place in a two-dimensional world. This is a flat world that might exist, you know, on the surface of your tabletop, right? So this is a world that's completely flat and is populated by two-dimensional objects, as objects with just length and width. So some of them were flat squares, some of them were flat circles or flat triangles, and even lines. They would all slide around on the surface of this flat world. And of course, they believed that they lived in a two-dimensional world until the climax of the novel, when a three-dimensional object, a sphere, inserts itself, goes down and inserts itself into the plane of Flatland. And there's a square character who looks out on his Flatland horizon and sees the appearance of this mysterious object, who starts talking to him. And the sphere says, you know, I'm a three-dimensional object, and I come from another world. And the square says, this can't be possible. And the sphere just cannot convince the square that their flat, two-dimensional world is embedded in a larger world. So the sphere resorts to a more extreme measure, and he reaches over and pulls the square off of the plane world of Flatland and up into three-dimensional space. And of course, then the square looks around and looks down on his flat world and can, for the first time, see the whole world spread out in front of him. So the square becomes a sort of a believer in the existence of a higher dimension, that there's a third dimension. And he goes back to his flat world, of course, and is pretty enthusiastic about this and can't stay quiet about it. And unfortunately, in Flatland, it's forbidden by the high priest to talk about the existence of a higher dimension. So he's put in jail, where he stays for a number of years. And the story ends with this poor flat square languishing in prison, hoping that some of his readers will be visionary enough to accept that there might be more than meets the eye to their reality. So he sort of used
the idea that the high priests of Flatland wouldn't allow anybody to talk about the other dimension.
Yeah.
I mean, a commentary on sort of maybe rigid dogma of our time.
Yeah, exactly. He was very interested in commenting on the sort of, as you say, the rigidity and the social norms of Victorian England, you know, where he lived, right? You sort of had to stay in your line and not have any wild thoughts. But the square character did have these wild thoughts and even had this visionary experience, right, where he saw that there was another space or direction to reality. So Abbott wrote the book just to kind of encourage people to, you know, think about the possibility that above our three spaces or three spatial dimensions, there might be others that we don't see. And we go through our life, you know, thinking that our world is the only world. But, you know, maybe there's something beyond.
Well, it's fun to talk about and fun to imagine. But when you combine higher dimensions and the multiverse, it gets pretty complicated. I tell you what, we won't jump into that. We'll take a break first, and we'll come back and get into that. The inspiration, some of the stories that you tell about people who are inspired by this idea are very sad. I mean, people who embrace it, and they go through trials and turmoils in trying to get their head around it, as I have.
Yeah.
We'll get into that in a moment. Talking with Christopher White about Other Worlds, Spirituality, and the Search for Invisible Dimensions. There are some themes like that in this book by Christopher White, Other Worlds, Spirituality and the Search for Invisible Dimensions. There's a character who's explained named J.B. Priestley. I wanted to share a quote with you because it sort of flows from what Robbie was singing about in that song there. Men have got to feel at home in the universe again, and I believe a great deal of the despair of our time is due to the fact that men, meaning people, have a false picture of the universe and our destiny. Having lost religion and gained nothing in its place, too many people have come to believe that life doesn't amount to much. There are several people who are profiled in the book who struggled with this, the apparent contradiction between spirituality and science. And we're going to get into a couple of the examples and how they got through it here in just a moment on Coast to Coast AM. We're back with Christopher White. Christopher, one of the great things about the book is how you tell the story about other worlds and our modern perception of other worlds and how it developed by personalizing it. You tell the story of people who have struggled with getting their own heads around it. Charles Hinton is one of those who, I guess, a brilliant mathematician who went into a deep depression when his scientific views came into conflict with his religious and spiritual views. Tell his story.
Yeah. His life is quite a story. But you're right. There's Hinton and there's many others in the book who sort of struggle with this. You know, sort of like Abbott, being raised religious in a scientific time and feeling that they can no longer, or maybe not sure that they can any longer embrace the religions of their childhood, and still feeling spiritual for sure, and having spiritual intuitions, and excuse me, and wanting to seek out other ways of being religious. And many of them turn to these, you know, fantastic scientific concepts like higher dimensions as a new, more scientific way of thinking about, you know, the existence of other spiritual levels or worlds to reality. Hinton's an interesting story. As you say, he grows up, he goes to Oxford, he falls into this kind of depression. He's not sure about anything anymore. And then he makes a move that I think not a lot of people would make, right, in the situation, is he embraces mathematics and geometry as a kind of he hangs on to that as the only sure thing, that there's a way in which the math provides certainty to him. So I think his story is a little bit unusual in that sense. But then he develops, as I say in the book, he develops this whole way of thinking about higher spatial dimensions, and he gets very interested in the mathematics of higher dimensions, which I mentioned earlier in our conversation. And then he starts to think, you know, well, what if these mathematical variables in my equation, you know, these higher dimensions that I'm using, what if they actually have a real existence somehow? You know, what if the math points us to the real existence of these kinds of spaces? And he thought a lot about that, and he does something unusual and kind of unique. He develops a way of what he thought of as sort of re-educating the senses in order to catch glimpses into this, into a higher dimensional world. So he develops a system of re-educating the senses. It involves, a set of 27 cubes that are labeled. All 27 are labeled, and then they're stacked up into like a Rubik's cube. You know, that's 3 by 3 by 3. And then he memorizes the positions of all of the squares in the Rubik's cube, and then he'll rotate the Rubik's cube, and then he'll memorize all those positions. It's essentially sort of an imaginative exercise, but he believed that by doing it, you're able to train yourself to perceive beyond the normal range of perceptions that we have. So, you know, his mathematical colleagues sort of shook their heads, I think. He was an assistant professor of math at Princeton for a while, but he didn't get tenure. You know, when you're trying to get tenure, you should be publishing and doing your research. But instead, he was doing things like putting these cube sets together and helping coach the Princeton baseball team. And he actually also invented a pitching gun, which was one of the first automated pitching devices ever invented. So he did that, and so he didn't get tenure at Princeton. he didn't do what he should have been doing, but he went on to the University of Minnesota, and then from there he just started writing popular books and articles about this idea that, you know, that there may be higher spatial dimensions, and these, you know, our ways of thinking about these things might be a new scientific way to talk about spirituality. But as you say, he was just one. There are many others in the book who are seeking for new scientific answers to their spiritual questions.
Well, as you document and trace, I mean, this idea catches on. It gets into pop culture. You've got priests and mystics and I would think con men and religious leaders who grab onto it, and they all use this idea for their own purposes.
Yeah, right? Absolutely. Absolutely. I mean, I think a lot of people then, you know, and now, a lot of people in the last 100 years are interested in scientific ideas as ways of as new ways of thinking about spirit or spirituality or afterlife or heaven and so on. And so Hinton's ideas and then Abbott's ideas, of course, in Flatland, both of their writings really become important. So modern artists take up these ideas, spiritual writers take up these ideas, a lot of religious people in the U.S. and in Europe take up these ideas. A number of Christians take up these ideas as well. You know, another person in the book, in chapter 8, is C.S. Lewis, right? Who I'm sure many of your listeners have heard of. C.S. Lewis,
sure. Narnia,
the famous British Christian apologist and Christian writer, probably the most 20th century's most famous Christian writer. he incorporates these ideas as well. You know, he incorporates ideas about higher dimensions to rethink Christian ideas such as the Trinity. And he incorporates them in a number of sermons and his writings. And then, of course, many people are familiar with his fantasy writings, and the same ideas are in there as well. He's got references to higher dimensions, and he uses these concepts there. And he was interested in them spiritually too. You know, he was raised in the church, but then he becomes an atheist. Like many characters in my book, actually, he goes off to war and becomes disillusioned. There's a number of people in there. You know, Priestley's in there, and James Bennett, and a number of people go off to World War I or World War II in the book, and they get into combat situations. Oh, J.W. Dunn is in there, also in combat.
They sort of have an epiphany or an out-of-body experience, right?
Yeah. Right, exactly. A number of those people have these kinds of experiences that really shake them to the core and cause them to sort of rethink reality and rethink religion. And for some of them, those war experiences you know, disillusion them and turn them off from religion. But others, like James Bennett, he has this kind of out-of-body experience, right, that I talk about in Chapter 6, which is a chapter really about dreams that seem to predict the future. Kind of a cool chapter. I really like that chapter. So he has this out-of-body experience, and then his journey is trying to figure out how mathematics and science, and especially the science of higher dimensions, how that might help explain what happened to him.
Well, let's talk about dreams a little bit. Explain it to me how this would work, how the idea of dreams. Are they coming from somewhere else, a higher reality, another reality?
Yeah. No, dreams are fascinating, and you know, dreams seem to be important in just about every culture around the world. You know, and in many cultures, people have dream interpreters, you know, special people who you tell your dream to, and then they tell you what it means. And we have that in our culture too, right? We have all kinds of dream interpretation books, and we have people like the Swiss psychotherapist Carl Jung, who many people know about, who is really important for people as they think about interpreting their dreams. And so, people have long thought about the spiritual meaning of dreams. And in my book, especially in that chapter 6, people are also wondering about the spiritual meaning of dreams. In that book, there's a figure whose name is J.W. Dunn, who is a British aeronautical engineer, also a soldier, and goes into combat in the Second Boer War in South Africa, right around the turn of the 20th century. He's in combat in 1902. And he starts to have dreams that surprise him. He starts to have dreams and nightmares, really, about terrible things happening. And the dreams then seem to happen in real life. So he has predictive dreams, or what are sometimes called precognitive dreams. He has dreams that seem to predict the future. And these surprise him. Like I said, they do begin, you know, as he's camped out with his platoon. So they seem to begin in combat situations, and he started having them, and at first he wondered if he was maybe going insane from the stress of battle and these kinds of things. But he would have dreams, and then he would wake up. Generally what happens is he would have dreams, and then he would wake up the next day or the day after that, he'd open the newspaper and see the event in the newspaper. So one of the dreams that he talks about in one of his books, he has a dream where he's sort of standing on a hill. He's looking down the hill towards the ocean. He's obviously on an island. He recognizes the island as someplace he's already been in his dreams. He notices that there's cracks and fissures in the ground, and the fissures are venting gas, that the ground is rumbling. People seem to be going about their business. They're speaking French. But he's panicked. He's trying to alert people. He knows that something is going to go wrong. He knows there's going to be a volcanic eruption. So he's running around trying to get people's attention. He doesn't speak French. They don't seem to speak English. He ends up talking to one official after another. No one really believes him. And he ends up waking up in kind of a sweat and a panic. And then a couple days later, he opens up the newspaper and he reads about this catastrophic volcanic eruption in the island of Martinique, the French-speaking island of Martinique. And several of the details from his dream are correct, and some of them aren't. some of them aren't as well. And he tries to think, you know, how could this be? How could in my dreams, how could I have seen an event that hasn't happened? And he keeps it to himself for a while, but is eventually discharged and heads back to the UK, where he actually is an early inventor of airplanes. And his you can Google him, J.W. Dunn, and you can Google him and check out his airplane designs. His airplanes were used by the British, and they were used by the Canadian military and others headed as those countries head towards World War I. But he tries to reflect on this. He's puzzled by these dreams. He's worried about them. He starts writing them down. And then he comes across basically the like people like Hinton and people who are talking about the possibility that there's higher dimensions. And he's reading Einstein. Well, he's reading about Einstein. He's reading sort of popular science. And he ends up developing a theory that the dreaming self can somehow lift itself up off of our normal world and peek into other parts in the timeline or other areas in the timeline. So the dreaming self, the dreaming consciousness has a kind of a freedom that that our regular everyday consciousness doesn't have. And he uses a lot of scientific ideas that we can talk about if you want to, how he does it. But he has a set of scientific ideas that he uses to think about how this might be possible. How could the dreaming self be able to have these powers and be able to lift itself off of our timeline and see into the future? He writes these ideas up in a book called An Experiment with Time. The book is from 1927. It becomes a kind of a bestseller, and a lot of people in Europe and America read the book and get interested in thinking about their dreams as somehow predicting the future. And, you know, I sometimes give talks about this in different places, and I always have audience members come up to me. I always have people emailing me saying, oh, I've had dreams like that. So, you know, it seems to be a fairly common experience, actually, that people in dreams seem to get glimpses of things that then happen in real life.
And then you have experiences where people are not sleeping, they're not dreaming, and they happen in while they're awake. Time slips, or deja vu, where they seem to be in some other reality, and then they come back to this one. So how do you
exactly.
how does that fit into the framework that you explore in this book?
Yeah, exactly. I talk about some of those experiences as well, also in that chapter 6, and then a little bit in the chapter on C.S. Lewis as well. And then I have a chapter on Madeleine L'Engle, right, who's the famous writer of Wrinkle in Time, just recently a movie made of that book. But she talks about time slips and time travel and so on in some of her books. So, yeah, how do they make sense of that?
Well, time is not linear, right? Like my present could be somebody else's future.
Yeah, well, for sure. I mean, I think one thing that Dunn picks up on is, as you say, that Einstein has a new way of talking about what time is, which is really counterintuitive and weird, right? I mean, before Einstein, people thought about time as just linear, as something that just flowed at a uniform rate, right? We have a sense of time flowing. We have this kind of intuitive sense that time flows forward. In fact, though, you know, Einstein had a number of counterintuitive things to say, but one of them was that the ways that we experience time is probably just an illusion and the product of the limitations of our own consciousness, that Einstein's equations for the universe really lay out something that looks a little bit different. They really lay out a universe that could be called a block universe, a universe that already exists. So, you know, all locations in the universe and all times in the universe already exist, and they're all laid out in this big block. We are kind of passing through that block, right? Or we occupy a little portion of that block, but every moment in our past and in our present and in our future and in the Earth's future and in our sun's future and all of our descendants' futures, all of those moments are already laid out in the block, at least according to the laws of physics. And this is actually discussed if anyone wants to look at it. It's discussed in my book, but you could also look at Brian Greene's books. He's a professor of physics at Columbia. He wrote a new book called The Fabric of the Cosmos, where he talks about this kind of block universe. So Dunn and
others... So it's all laid out. You know, what does that say about destiny and free will and things of that sort? The kind of questions that you, as a professor of religious studies, tackle all the time.
Yeah, you're right. It lays out these big philosophical issues, right? Like fate and destiny and human free will and how free are we to make choices, and so on. And we can definitely talk about those issues. I mean, one thing that Dunn did, and some of the other people in my book did as they thought through these problems was they said, you know, I think what's happening is that, you know, the fact that these future moments are already laid out somehow in the block universe makes it more plausible or makes it more possible that, you know, maybe the dreaming self could somehow lift itself up above our three-dimensional world, or I should say our four-dimensional world, right, because we have three spatial dimensions and one temporal dimension. The dreaming self, he said, can lift up out of that block universe and peek into future moments. And Dunn believed that, you know, using a bit of Einstein here and a bit of, you know, Hinton and higher space philosophers there, that's what he believed was happening. Somehow the dreaming consciousness had an additional degree of freedom, an additional direction that it could move in. We could talk about that as an additional spatial dimension, or we could talk about that as, you know, maybe consciousness somehow can move with an additional degree of freedom. But that's what he thought. And he thought everybody's sleeping self had this degree of freedom. And he also believed that everyone, if they kept a journal by their bed of their dreams and they followed, he had a couple of recommendations for how to do a dream journal. He believed that if everyone did it, they would be able to see that all of our dreams contain bits and pieces of future events and past events, sort of mixed up together.
Well, so I guess the central question for me about higher dimensions is, are there people there and can they interact with us, or is it us that's over there? We're going to get into that, those topics, as well as near-death experiences. I want to talk about seances, shaman, remote viewers, how some of those ideas that we have discussed on this program before might fit into our discussion of Other Worlds, the book Spirituality and the Search for Invisible Dimensions by Christopher White. We're going to take a break and be back in a moment.